I want to begin this morning by talking about essential qualities for effective pastoring in a Highways and Hedges church. Essential qualities for effective pastoring in a Highways and Hedges church. Let me share this with you. For the first 15 years of my ministry as a Christian school principal, an assistant pastor, and what have you, I served with some of the most hard-nosed preachers that I know of. Many of you haven't been there before. I have served with, pardon me, some of the meanest preachers. You know what I'm talking about? When we were on staff, us guys were on staff, we would always talk about not bringing first-time visitors, but last-time visitors. That they would come, but they wouldn't come back. That's where I was for about 15 years in ministry. And then I became a senior pastor. I'm on my own. I come to Michigan. Didn't know a pastor in this state. I mean, there's not a large ministerial association out of Louisiana State University where I graduated. Okay? I came up basically more of an apprentice-type program. Graduated from LSU, going to be a school teacher. Our church down in Baton Rouge wanted to start a Christian school. I had to make a decision. Am I going to go into ministry, or am I going to be a public school teacher? Well, the Lord led me into ministry as a Christian school teacher, then shortly thereafter, the principal of a big school down in Louisiana. And I thank God for those experiences. But the group that I was affiliated with, the group in which I got saved, it was a tough group of guys. I mean, tough group of guys. And I have an appreciation, though, now for preachers who, to me, this is just personal opinion, who demonstrate a more biblical approach to ministry than really what was modeled to me for a number of years. And I want us to look at it this morning and trust it'll be a blessing. One thing we have in here, we've got a few young preachers, but there's a lot of seasoned preachers in here. And any one of you could be up here, and probably for most of you, you're already practicing this. But if you're like me, sometimes I can forget, or like I did with Sunday school, I can let something that's important begin to slip. And maybe this morning, this will be just a refresher for many of you. But I want to begin, first of all, talking about and kind of laying the groundwork for today as to why we have a small town conference. Because, to my knowledge, this is the only one of its kind. Now, there may be. Missouri may have one. There may be one in California. But I don't know about it. Now, in evangelical circles, they have them. They have some pretty good size ones. But in our, what I would call our circle, I don't know of anybody else that's doing it. Not saying it's not being done. But I want to kind of lay the groundwork as to why. Why have a rural pastors' conference? Well, let's look at some facts before we get to 1 Thessalonians. Number one, fact. Most graduates are trained for ministry in urban populations using models from bigger ministries in metropolitan areas. Okay? There's all sorts of books out there. There's all sorts of conferences you go to, and usually they're hosted by the big churches in the city or suburban areas. And that's all well and good, and it serves a useful purpose. And that's where most people are trained. But fact number two. 3 out of 4 graduates seeking a pastorate will find themselves in a small town or country church. Do you realize that? Most men start in a small town or country church. And it's a fact that many graduates from Bible colleges are ill-prepared for ministry in rural settings. Now, for what it's worth, what is a rural setting? What constitutes country? Well, let's look at how our government labels country. That's a good place to start. You know, sociologists. What's country? Well, number one, a town with a population of 2,500 or less. That's considered, you know, in statistics, a small town. Or a population density of 100 people per square mile. If you have 100 people per square mile or less, that's considered small town. What does Detroit have? Look at that. 5,000 people per square mile. Most of us in this room are dealing with less than 100 people per square mile. That makes for differences, folks. That makes for major differences. A rural setting is described as basically a farming economy. are people that live off the land. Somebody asked me already this morning, where do people work here? Well, most of them don't. Yeah, seriously, this Oscoda County is a welfare state. When they started making people work in the 90s, you know, they moved up here because there was no work. And they couldn't put them to work. So they drink, smoke, hunt, and fish year-round. And that's a sad truth. But as far as a basic economy here, it's the woods, it's the timber, it's the sawmills, it's that sort of thing. That's the basis of this economy in this county. And then also isolation from most goods and services. If you have to drive a half hour for most goods and services, then, you know, you're definitely a rural town or a rural community. You know, don't we usually gauge it by Walmart? How far is the closest Walmart? And, you know, if you got a Walmart less than a half hour from you, man, you're a city slicker. You know? But for most of us, it's going to be a half hour or more. Let me give you real quick. This is going to be kind of dry. I understand that. But again, I want you to see that there's real differences. If you were raised in the country, you minister in the country, you might not be aware of these differences. I was raised in the city. You know, I went to a college in the city. Before I came here, I was on church staff in Chicago. So I was very much aware that when I came here, that there's big differences. And it's not to say that necessarily one is right and one is wrong. It is to say that they're different. Let me give you these differences. There's environmental differences. In a rural setting, there's close, direct contact with nature. Influenced by natural environment, elements like rain, heat, drought, frost, snow, over which there is no control. In an urban setting, there's greater isolation from nature. The predominance of what you see is man-made. When I lived in Chicago, most everything I looked at was man-made. Living up here, most everything I see is God-made. I'll take this over man-made any day. Occupations. We're different. In a rural setting, agriculture is the fundamental occupation. The majority of the population is engaged in agriculture or getting something from the ground. In some cases, it may be mining. In an urban setting, no fundamental occupation. Most of the people engaged in principally in manufacturing, mechanical pursuits, trade, commerce, professions, and other non-agricultural occupations. People in these two worlds think differently. And we're wise to understand that. Number three, homogeneity and heterogeneity of population. In a rural setting, it's more homogeneous in social, racial, and psychological traits. Up here, when you see a black person in Mayo, it's like, wow, looky there. I mean, it's rare up here. And I'm not making fun of black people at all. Don't take that as wrong. I'm just stating a fact that we're much more of the same type. Whereas in an urban setting, it's more heterogeneous. Greater diversification in religions. I mean, you may go through a Chinese neighborhood. You may go through an Arab neighborhood, a Greek neighborhood. Social mobility. Differences. In a rural setting, mobility is less intensive. They follow the same occupation, stay in the same village. You have families that's been on the same homestead for years up here. Now, the exception to that, sadly, from my perspective, is the young people that grow up and they move off. If we could keep the young people here in Mayo, we'd be running double in attendance what we are today. But the vast majority, now here in recent years, there's been a little change in that trend, thankfully, but for the most part, over the last 22 years, the vast majority of our young people, especially if they go off to college or Christian college, they don't come back. And that's probably, you know, probably many of you can identify with that. Social mobility in the urban setting is more intensive. People change occupation and even leave places in search of new and better occupation. Real quick, social solidarity. This is a critical factor. Social solidarity or cohesiveness and unity are stronger, greater than urban. Common traits, similarity of experiences, common aims and purposes, common customs and traditions are the basis of unity in a village. Strong sense of belonging and unity. In an urban setting, social solidarity is less stronger than rural. Dissimilarities, division of labor, interdependence, specialization, impersonal, strictly formal relationships results comparatively less sense of belonging and unity. Up here in a rural setting, you may know your neighbors 5 miles down the road, and 5 miles down the road, they're still your neighbor up in this setting. I lived in Chicago suburbs. had no idea who my two next door neighbors were. Now, different. It's different. Social control in a rural setting. Social pressure by community is strong. Conformity to the norms is more by informal social pressure. Urban control is more by formal, impersonal means of laws, prescribed rules, and regulations. Social change in a rural setting. Rural social life is relatively static and stable. In an urban setting, social life is under constant and rapid social change. How about leadership patterns? I very much believe that the Bible teaches pastoral leadership. The difference is, how do you effectively lead in a rural setting as opposed to an urban setting? Well, isn't it exactly the same? You're entitled to that if that's what you think. I mean, yes, it's the same God. Yes, it's the same Bible, but you're not dealing with the same people. In a rural setting, choice of leadership more on the basis of known personal qualities of individual, due to greater face-to-face contacts and more intimate knowledge of individual. In an urban setting, choices of leadership is comparatively less on the basis of knowing them personal or known personal qualities of the individual. A way I can explain that, an illustration of that, is if I go to a rural church, no, if I go to a city church and I'm sitting with the pastor, somebody's walking up the aisle there, and I asked the pastor, and this is in a city setting, who is that? I mentioned this a couple of years ago. I said, who is that? And they said, oh, that's John Miller. And he is an esteemed member of Miller, Loggins, and French, a law firm. Oh, they just settled this big case, and he's on the Chamber of Commerce and all this kind of stuff. That's who that is. That's John Miller. Now, I go to a rural church. That same man comes walking down the aisle. And I say, who's that? And I'm with that rural pastor. He says, oh, that's John Miller. That's Helen and Ernie's boy. You know, they live down the road there at such and such a place. They look at things differently. When I candidated here, they didn't ask what my credentials were. They were sizing me up as a person. What kind of person am I going to be? And when we understand that, we put ourselves in a much better position to lead. How does cultural differences between rural and urban ministry affect leadership? And in my humble opinion, it does. In an urban setting, it's a vertical top-down model. Pastoring in an urban setting is based more on a business model. Whereas typically, and I know there's exceptions to everything I'm saying, yours may be an exception. But typically, in a rural setting, it's more of a horizontal type of leadership. Pastoring in a rural setting is based more on a family model. There's not very many books out there on small town and rural ministry, but I want to quote from one of the ones that I thought was very valuable. These are insights from the author of the book. Let me read you these quotes. He says, and this is just another preacher's understanding of rural ministry and leadership challenges. He says, and I quote, you see on the screen behind me, small church ministry has an air of impermanence about it. As a small church minister, you may be painfully aware that if you lose one or two more families, the congregation won't be able to pay your salary. Amen? I mean, that's sometimes a reality. He also stated this, many pastors move from small congregation to small congregation, trying to implement megachurch strategies and always being shocked and saddened when their ministries fall apart. That can happen too. Not to say that everything at big ministries can't be, you know, that anything can't be applied, but we just have to be careful. He also made this comment in his book. He said, criticism comes our way in the small church, not necessarily because smaller congregations are filled with cranky people, though some are, but because the small church is like a family. In a family, one freely voices concerns and wishes about how the home should be. Amen? Isn't that true? You know, people in small towns, I found, take a greater ownership of their church. Why is that? Because they don't operate in corporate America. In big cities, they operate, the people, the congregation, many of them operate in corporate America, top-down leadership. Tell us what to do and we'll do it. In rural America, they don't work for anybody. Most of them are self-employed. And they're not used to anybody telling them what to do. In fact, they're more used to telling you what to do. You know, and they take ownership. Grandma Jeannie came to this church 50 years ago. And they take ownership of it. That can be very good, but sometimes that can be challenging. And it's just having the wisdom to understand what we're dealing with and dealing with it. So, where would I point us this morning? I point us to a biblical model for leadership. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. And Casey, I tell you what, let's skip down to slide number 17. I won't read the whole passage. We'll read it as we go. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 here, the Apostle Paul is describing how he handled that congregation. And I interpret this as citing 10 qualities. I see 10 qualities. As he's describing his relationship with that congregation, I see 10 qualities in the Apostle Paul that I believe you and I, if at all possible, should try to emulate. And I'm running out of time, and the bell lady's going to ring it on me too. So let me just go through these quickly, and you can follow up on them yourself. I read in verses 1 and 2 of 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 that Paul obviously was a man of courage. He says, "For yourselves, brethren, know how our entrance in unto you, that it was not in vain, but even after that we had suffered before and were shamefully entreated, as ye know at Philippi, we were bold in our God to speak unto you the gospel of God with much contention." We need to love our people, but we need to be bold. We need to be willing to take on the issues today that threaten the health and welfare and spiritual well-being of our people. And we've got to be willing to trust God. What I see here, Paul is acknowledging, "I was bold before you." I would label that as being courageous. We need to follow that. We need to be courageous. Number two, I see where Paul demonstrated integrity. For he says, "For our exhortation was not of deceit, nor of uncleanness, nor in guile." He is saying, "I maintained integrity with you." And we all know of preachers who have probably messed up there, whose motives can be questioned. Our motives can't be questioned. We have to be men and women of integrity. Number three, I see him demonstrating faithfulness. "But as we were allowed of God to be put in trust with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God which trieth our hearts." I interpret that Paul was a man who was faithful to God. I really, personal opinion, I really don't think, fellas, we're going to be judged on our numbers. But we are definitely going to be judged by our faithfulness, or lack thereof. I think we need to be faithful to God's Word, and He'll take care of the numbers. Not that, you know, we all want to grow. We all want to reach people. But bottom line is our faithfulness to the truth. And when we start compromising on that to reach more people, folks, the more and more we become worldly, the more and more as a church we become irrelevant. Number four, sincerity. "For neither at any time use we flattering words, as ye know, nor a cloak of covetousness. God is witness." He was sincere. It was his heart. It was real. He's not playing games. He's not trying to move up the ecclesiastical ladder. He's not trying to influence anybody in the church or his peers outside the church. Number five, humility. Verse number six, he said, "Nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, nor yet of others, when we might have been burdensome as the apostle of Christ." He was humble. I have been around some, what I would guess, I would label big name preachers. They expected adoration. They expected to be treated in a certain way. They expected certain things to be done for them. And it was a privilege for you to get to meet them or spend some time with them. What does Paul say? He said, "We didn't seek glory of people." Humility. Number six, affection. He says, "But we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherisheth her children." We need to have a true love for our people. I don't do it enough, but I do tell our people that I love them. I had a man visiting. He was visiting his brother. This man is a faithful member of some other church. I don't even think it's an independent Baptist church, but he attends another church. I got one of the nicest letters I've ever gotten from anybody. And he wrote, he said, "I so was encouraged by hearing you tell your people that you love them." He said, "I have been at church, this church, I forget how many years." He said, "Never one time have I heard my pastor say, 'I love you.'" And maybe we're just not that warm and fuzzy, but we need to be. We need to be. Affection. Number 7, sacrifice. "So being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel only, but also our own souls, because you were dear to us." They were willing to sacrifice. And I think probably most of the men and women in this room do just that. You know, do just that. You sacrifice a lot of things. And true, there's a lot of blessings. But there are some real sacrifices. Number 8, this is one of my personal pet. If I had time to park it, I'd park it right here. Work. "For ye remember, brethren, our labor and travail, for laboring night and day, because we would not be chargeable unto any of you. We preached unto you the gospel of God." I realize, talking to a preacher before the service, having some health problems. He says, "I don't have the energy I used to have." Man, I understand that. He's probably working harder right now than he should be. But let me say this, there is no place in ministry for a lazy man. No place in ministry for a lazy man. I mean, the Lord worked. The Lord was tired. The apostles were tired. And look at what Paul says. He says, laboring night and day. Number 9, example. "Ye are witnesses in God also how holily and justly and unblameably we behaved ourselves among you that believe." I hate that bell. We need to be an example. Real quick, my son traveled for a school. And he said, "Dad," he says, "I'm amazed how some preachers preach one thing in the pulpit and we go in the home." He said, "You wouldn't believe what they're watching on TV." He was shocked. And that's, I'm sure that's rare. But Matt saw that often enough that it concerned him. We need to be an example. Last, we're done. "As you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father doth his children, that ye would walk worthy of God who hath called you unto his kingdom and glory." He was a man of encouragement. He said, "We exhorted you." I study preachers because I want to get better. I'm 61 years old. I haven't arrived. I got a lot to learn. The older I get, Brother Brown, the more I realize I've got to learn. But one thing I've observed: if you want to see a church that is moving forward, check out the man behind the pulpit and the degree of enthusiasm in his life. Fellas, we need to be exhorters. We need to be cheerleaders. We need to be... I know we have disappointments. I know we're in a tough economy. I know some of our towns, like Mile, and this county, has lost population over the last 5 years. I understand that. But we still serve the King. And as long as He's on the throne, we got a lot to be excited about.